welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. In this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss. We're on the second book of the collection. It's called Sea Queen. We're on chapter 2, and this is the 23rd part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 2. The Sea Queen, after completing repairs and with everything ready for sea again, left Ikawa on August the 22nd at 3:30 in the afternoon and proceeded on her course toward the Marshall Islands. When outside the harbour, we steered southeast by east. The weather was dull, with a heavy swell setting from the northeast. The wind being light, our progress was slow, and at midnight, Kinkasan Island was bearing north by west, distant 19 miles. On the following 2 days, we experienced light and variable winds accompanied by spells of calm. August the 25th, the Sea Queen's usual headwind arrived, starting to blow from the east and accompanied by a choppy sea. Similar conditions were experienced on the 26th and 27th, the wind blowing from the east with increasing seas and heavy rain squalls. The boat was kept going to the southwest. On August the 28th, our position at noon was latitude 32 degrees 40 minutes north and longitude 145 degrees 5 minutes east. This day came in with strong southeasterly breeze, accompanied by heavy rain squalls, and a very large swell set in from the same direction. Towards noon, the weather cleared and the wind moderated, and the swell kept on increasing. According to the state of the weather and the swell setting in from the southeast, I said to myself, I should not be at all surprised if we get a change, and that it will be from bad to worse, as according to indications, a typhoon was approaching. I, however, kept my thoughts to myself till the following day, August the 29th, which was ushered in with a moderate easterly breeze and clear weather. Apparently, Father Neptune was trying to make things a little easier for the crew of the Sea Queen, but the large southeasterly swell continued, and at about 9 o'clock, a large heavy-looking ring of varied fiery colours formed round the sun. The atmosphere became very sultry, and the appearance of a dense bank of clouds, a threatening appearance on the horizon, convinced me that the dread visitor was close at hand, and that I would be called upon to prove the statement I had so often made, i.e., that a small vessel is as safe at sea in a gale as a large one. It was then that I spoke to my two shipmates about the approaching typhoon. The large circle and the similar appearance of the sky followed the sun round till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, after which the sun disappeared behind the cloud bank on the horizon. Between sunset and dark, the clouds which covered the sky became a fiery hue. The weather during the night was warm and pleasant, and anyone who does not understand the indications of a typhoon would not have thought that inside of 30 hours, the Sea Queen would lay in the centre of one of the worst typhoons that has ever blown in the North Pacific. When darkness set in and the angry clouds had disappeared, the only indication of the approaching typhoon was the southeasterly swell and the barometer, which, however, was not a low glass by any means. At 8 o'clock it stood at 29.80, but was going down steadily, and between this and the increase in size of the tremendous swell, which almost began to break, I was sure that the approaching hurricane was not far off. August the 30th came in with a light, baffling wind, flying about between east and south and accompanied by a dark, cloudy sky. At 6 o'clock, the wind settled in the southeast with increasing force and occasionally heavy rain squalls. At noon, Port Lloyd of the Bonin group bore south by west, half west, 245 miles. An hour later, as the wind was still increasing and the squalls getting heavier, we laid the boat to under a reefed mizzen and storm staysail. But at 2 o'clock we were obliged to put the little vessel under sea anchor and riding sail. The barometer registered 29.45 and was falling steadily. During the afternoon and night the wind continued to increase in force, accompanied by heavy rain squalls and breaking seas, and by 2 o'clock the following morning the force of the wind was that of a heavy gale, and as the seas were breaking badly we hung two oil bags over the side, which we changed every hour. The proud little Sea Queen rode the large seas as they came along. Now and then a sea would break near us, and she would give a little extra roll. At 8 o'clock it was blowing so hard that I did not think it possible for the wind and sea to increase, and seeing that the boat was laying head to wind, with her drag ahead and a reefed mizzen over her stern, and in spite of the large seas lying quite comfortably, I told my shipmates that the little vessel would weather the typhoon without much trouble, and I'm certain she would have done so had our storm gear been stronger. After making the cruises in the Zora and the Tilikum, I thought I surely knew all about the sea and what was required to manage a small vessel through a heavy gale. As far as heavy gales are concerned, I am quite sure I did understand the management of a boat, but was convinced that morning that I still had to learn something about typhoons. At 9, the wind blew with such force that it was impossible to stand on deck, and we were obliged to lie flat down in the cockpit and hang on for dear life. Still, the gallant little boat kept facing the gale, and it was most wonderful how she got over the top of the tremendous seas. Up to an hour previously, the oil bags did quite a lot of good in keeping the break off the large seas, but now the oil seemed to have little effect, and no trace could be detected on the water. Nevertheless, my two mates were employed in the cabin, getting the bags ready, while I looked after them outside, thinking that if the oil did no good, it would not be harmful. The water was then flying over the boat like a heavy snowdrift, and it was impossible to look up against it, but fortunately no heavy seas came aboard, and there was therefore no danger of the vessel foundering. Vincent and Stone every now and then would open the cabin scuttle a little to inquire how we were getting along, and my reply was always the same, "All right." Shortly after 9, when I noticed the boat fell sideways into the seas, the mizzen sheet parted. "All hands on deck," I yelled. In a second, my two mates were alongside me. All three of us were crawling about the deck on all fours on the after end of the vessel, and with the seas washing over us, we managed to take in the mizzen and save the sail. We then found that the sea anchor was lost. Stone managed to get forward and pull the anchor rope on board, and Vincent and I got busy and made a temporary sea anchor by tying together the cabin ladder and one of our anchors. All this had to be done while lying flat upon the deck. After fastening the anchor line to the temporary sea anchor, we dropped it overboard, and as it was impossible to set the mizzen again, we were obliged to let the vessel lay to this temporary arrangement alone. Owing to the fact that this sea anchor was not much of a drag, and being without the aid of the storm sail, it did not do much good. Shortly before 11 o'clock, we lost the temporary sea anchor also, and the boat then lay side on to the sea. The rudder, up to this time, had been lashed amidships, but as the boat was lying sideways to the sea, I took the rudder lashings off to allow it to swing about and give her a better chance to drift sideways with the seas. My two mates were down in the cabin again, and I was lying in the cockpit holding on with one hand and with the other keeping the oil bags in the water, when a huge sea struck the boat and put her on her beam ends, in which position she remained for just a second or two. I wondered what would happen next, whether she would recover or turn turtle. I was not left long in doubt, for I then felt a little jerk which told me that the boat was turning bottom up, and to save myself from getting under her, I let go my hold. The next moment I was in the water and felt certain that it was all up with us. In fact, I took two big mouthfuls of water, thinking to go down quickly and be done with it. When a man gets into a fix of that kind, however, many thoughts will run through his mind, and after I had said goodbye to the world and taken in the water ballast, I thought of my two young shipmates who were inside the boat and unable to get out, and wished just to see them once more to say goodbye. By that time I had been underwater long enough to be dead, but wasn't. I popped up again behind the stern of the boat and saw the Sea Queen in front of me with her keel pointing to the sky. I made one kick and grabbed hold of her stern, and then made up my mind to get on her bottom and do something towards righting her again. I have heard it said that while there's life, there's hope, and where there's a will, there's a way. At that time I was still alive and had a little will left, but I thought it was going hard with the hopes and ways. Anyway, I made use of the little determination that remained and climbed over the stern of the boat. Just as I got on the bottom, I saw an enormous breaking sea coming towards us, so I dug my nails into the keel to avoid getting washed off again. In a second, the sea struck the boat along the keel, but I managed to hang on. The same sea caused the boat to heel over, and the weight of the iron on the keel slowly but surely brought her right side up again, and as she turned over, I scrambled over the gunwale, and by the time the little vessel was floating on her bottom again, I was in the cockpit. The next thing I saw, the scuttle opened, and I heard Vincent shouting at the top of his voice, "Are you there, Captain?" And then my two shipmates leapt out of the cabin. No doubt some of my readers have seen two porpoises jumping out of the water at sea, one after the other. Well, it looked just like that to me. In spite of being on a small craft which was broadside on to the worst storm and largest sea that I ever experienced in all my years at sea, and all three of us lying down in the cockpit and hanging on for dear life, our meeting after the incident was quite joyous. And if the boat got smashed up in the typhoon, it would at least have given us a chance to say goodbye to each other. The storm was then at its worst, and the force of the wind was that of several concentrated heavy gales. Large seas were washing over us in rapid succession. Owing to the wind, the heavy rain and salt water spray, we were absolutely unable to open our eyes when facing to windward, and could only see about 100 feet to leeward. Every few minutes, the little vessel was heeled over with the mast in the water. The vessel and gear up to that time were still in good order, and nothing had been lost or broken, but in turning upside down, a tremendous amount of water got into her. We were lying with our starboard side to the sea and wind, and as our cabin scuttle was on the port side, it was taken underwater every time the boat was thrown on her beam ends, and consequently, much water got into the cabin. It was impossible to open the cabin door while the boat was lying on the starboard tack, and we were therefore unable to bail her out. At the same time, I was certain that if she kept in the same position for another 20 minutes, she would have filled with water and foundered. So the only thing that could possibly be done was to put the boat on the port tack, and owing to the condition we were in, it had to be done quickly. Consequently, I told my mates to hold on tight so that none of us would get washed overboard during the operation. I then put the helm up to get headway on the boat, and to make her steer, I slacked the main boom off. No sooner was that done than the little vessel started to go ahead, and in a few seconds we were round on the other tack. Everything had gone wonderfully well until the boat came sideways to the sea, and as she was still going ahead, a sea broke over the top of us and smashed the main boom. This was the first thing, apart from the sea anchor, that had got broken until then. The next thing to be done was to bail some of the water out of the boat. Stone and Vincent both knew what it was like to be in the cabin when she turned bottom up, and both being good swimmers, elected to take their chance on deck. I myself, being a very poor swimmer, stood a better chance inside, so it was therefore agreed that Vincent and Stone would tend the scuttle, keeping it open when there was a chance, and I went below to bail her out. It was also agreed that in the event of the boat turning bottom up again, my two faithful, athletic shipmates would get on the lee side of her bottom and help the large seas to right her again. The scuttle of the cabin door was then opened, and I made a dive into the cabin. No sooner was I inside than the scuttle was closed over my head and the boat thrown on her beam. I felt sure that she would turn bottom up again, and with all the water that was already inside, I thought it must be the last of us. To my surprise, however, she righted herself to an angle of about 45 degrees, which of course raised the scuttle out of the water, and it was at once slightly opened by my mates on deck. I shall never forget the sight that met my eyes in the cabin. Apart from having a good opinion of my ability to handle boats at sea, I also thought I had learned all there was to know about stowing stores and cargo so that they could not shift in any weather. In this I was rudely disillusioned, and consequently I came to the conclusion that I was adding to my experiences during that typhoon in more than one sense. The boat was just about one third full of water, in which were floating pieces of our gramophone and many records, amongst them Life on the Ocean Wave. Our photographic outfit, tinned goods of various descriptions, bedding, blankets, books, clothing, silver watches, gold chains, and navigation instruments were washing about in a mixture of fish oil, kept for use against stormy seas, which had got upset amongst the lot. Now, the smell of fish oil is about the least dainty perfume I can possibly think of. The smell and the rolling of the boat, with everything washing from one side of the cabin to the other, and myself amongst it, almost turned me seasick. But I gave my stomach to understand that I could not afford to be particular just then, but was obliged to set to work to get some of the water out. For a bailer, I used a 5-pound sugar tin, and whenever my mates outside had an opportunity to open the scuttle far enough, I threw some water out. It was certainly bailing under difficulties, for nearly every minute the boat was thrown on her beam ends and the scuttle had to be closed till she righted again. Then instantly the scuttle would be opened, and I emptied the tin as fast as I possibly could. We had kept up the performance for about an hour, and as I had made very little impression on the water in the cabin, I thought that the little vessel must have sprung a leak. But as it was a matter of life or death, we just kept at it. A little later, Vincent opened the scuttle, just enough to shout through the opening, "Stone is overboard!" and then quickly closed it to keep the water from pouring into the cabin, for again the boat was put on her beam ends. Next time she righted, the scuttle was opened and Vincent shouted, "He's on board again!" Of course, I was quite certain that neither of my shipmates would get away from the boat as long as she kept afloat. We had been working hard for 3 hours, and in spite of the boat being thrown on her beam ends time after time, she never turned turtle again, and the water was then pretty well out of her. Vincent opened the scuttle again and said, "Captain, I think we are in the centre of the typhoon." "No, not in the centre yet," I answered, "but I think we will be shortly, and the sooner we get there, the better." I knew by that time that in spite of the tremendous size of the breaking seas, they could not harm our little vessel, but that it was the terrible strength of the wind that forced her bottom upwards and put her on her beam ends time after time. I knew also that in the centre of the typhoon there would be no wind and we should be all right. Stone got washed overboard a second time, and the nerve-wracking experiences were now beginning to tell upon both my companions, so as the cabin was free of water and nothing further could be done on deck, I advised them to come down into the cabin. We then shut the door up as tightly as we could and waited for further developments. Our timepieces being out of action, we did not know the exact hour, but I think it was between 2 and 3 in the afternoon that the barometer registered 28:25, and after the three of us had been sitting down some time, expecting the boat to turn turtle again any second, we were surprised at her righting herself on an even keel. I at once opened the scuttle and found that we were in a dead calm, and that both masts and all the gear were overboard. All three of us lost no time in getting the broken spars, gear, and sails on board again, and we were then in the centre of the typhoon. I have heard ship captains say that once a vessel gets into the centre of the typhoon, she will never get out again. After my experience, I can quite agree where a large vessel is concerned, as with such tremendous seas and without a breath of wind, she would roll herself to pieces. But the Sea Queen did not mind it in the least. She just simply bobbed up and down as the seas came along. I never had a better chance to prove my statement, both while the typhoon was blowing and after we got into the centre of it, that in a heavy gale, be they large or small, as long as their headway is stopped and they are allowed to take a natural drift with the sea and wind, a sea has no power on vessels, and if it does roll on board a large vessel, there is no force behind it. After we got all our gear aboard and well secured on deck, we cleared up the cabin, and of course everything was soaked with salt water and fish oil. You may talk of the odour of bad eggs. It isn't even in it with the smell of fish oil. All our bedding was saturated, and consequently we were obliged to transfer it to the deck and manage without it for the time being. We only had one thing dry in the boat, and that was our matches, which we kept in sealed bottles. Our stove was similar to the one I used on the Tillicum, which, like my sea anchor, never failed me. On this occasion, however, the sea anchor had failed to do its duty, but the stove, in spite of being tumbled about in the cabin, was there, ready when wanted. And in a very short time we had water boiling and made a good cup of coffee, which put us all three in good humour again. This was the first time in all my experiences in small vessels at sea that I was obliged, owing to the weather, to go without my regular meals. As the barometer remained stationary, we were certain that the second half of the typhoon was near at hand. We were not mistaken, for in about half an hour's time, we entered the second stage. It then blew very hard for about 4 hours from the west, but with the spars out of her, it was a picnic for the little vessel. Shortly after the wind changed, the barometer started to rise, and by midnight showed 28:55. During the following 24 hours, the weather gradually cleared, but as there was still a large sea and strong wind from the west, we were unable to do anything towards repairing the damage. September 2nd came in with a moderate breeze and a large westerly swell, and as the boat was still tumbling about quite a lot, we were unable to do anything to our mainmast. but managed to lash together a piece of the broken mizzenmast and a spinnaker boom, and after some difficulty, we managed to step the same in place of the mainmast. Owing to the flimsiness of our temporary jury mast, all it would carry was the storm staysail. During that day and night, we experienced fresh southwest breezes, and with our staysail, made 1.5 miles an hour to the north-northwest. The distance from Yokohama was about 350 miles. September the 3rd came in with a moderate southwesterly breeze. At daybreak, the wind became very light, and as the sea was quite smooth, we went to work brightly and early to look over the damage that had been done and to repair it as best we could. In our survey, we found that the mainmast had been broken just above the deck and about 3 feet below the eyes of the rigging, the main boom about 4 feet from the inner end, and the mizzenmast, like the mainmast, just above the deck, about 5 feet higher up and again just below the eyes of the rigging. The rigging and chain plates were in good order, so the two masts had simply buckled up and, by the force of the wind, blown out of the boat in pieces. The rudder post was broken in the top part of the rudder blade. The hull of the boat was as good as ever. The dimensions of the mainmast were length from deck to eyes of shrouds, 21 feet 9 inches, diameter at the lower break, 5 inches, diameter at the upper break, 4.5 inches, length of mizzenmast from deck to eyes of shrouds, 15 feet, diameter at lower break, 4 inches, at next break, 4 inches, and at the eyes of the rigging, 3 inches. Both masts were made of Japanese pine, and at the time they blew out of the boat, she was lying sideways to the sea and wind at an angle of about 45 degrees away from the wind. Now, I should like to know, what was the speed of the wind when the masts were broken? Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.